Okay. So yes, thank you very much for this invitation to be here today to speculate together with everyone. And do you mind if I close this? It's disturbing. So I think I need to preface a little bit my paper today, because it is really not about something that I've been writing or thinking about. Actually, I've been thinking about, but it's not really my scholarship. And it's also kind of a coming out in terms of writing and sharing publicly some ideas, because as a performance studies scholar, I have this problem of sharing my personal experiences in my scholarship. And it's something that I envy in my colleagues like Barbara Browning or Deborah Capshon and Alex Vasquez, that somehow implicate their embodied experience in their scholarship. And so I thought, you know, why not do this today? Why not coming out with my embodied experience? And the only relation that actually I found with Nicola's paper, and this is something else that you need to do, is the fourth or last epigraph to your presentation, which was this observation by a friend of yours who's a rock climber. So it has to do with rock climbing. It has to do with the fact that, you know, 3 years ago, for some chance encounter, I found myself dangling 20 meters high on a rope in Rio de Janeiro. I was taking my kids to do something in the afternoon, and we thought, let's just climb this rock. So we decided to do that. And from that moment on, something really impersonal took over my subjectivity, or my body, if you want to use those words. And I became obsessed with it. So I thought that today I'd like to think a little bit more about what that obsession might be and where it could take us. And I think there's something profoundly related to sound. So basically, it's a weird paper. Forgive me, but you know, we're gonna have lunch after. So you know, it's like a confessions of mineral life. So so just as a kind of preface, what I'd like to do is to, as the title indicates, is to look at rocks as a kind of flesh. And particularly after what geology has found out recently, that about 95% of the minerals on Earth today derive from the metabolic processes of living organisms, which is something absolutely extraordinary. I'll talk about this a little bit further. So, but I'm framing this speculation as a kind of variation over what UC Parikka, in his beautiful book called The Anthropocene, has called metal metaphysics. But I'm interested in mineral metaphysics and what it might indicate as resonance between the organic and the inorganic, to such a point where the distinction between both becomes senseless. So towards the end, it will become a sonic guide to rock climbing. And I don't know, anyone rock climbs here or does boulder? Great, okay, so let's see like what happens if you take the sonic as a guide, okay. Why not? Okay, so number one, a note on speculation. My usage of the term speculative is derived from the speculative pragmatic philosophy of Masumi, particularly when he invokes the political potentiality of the speculative dimension of language, a dimension that, not surprisingly, Masumi explicitly links to Walter Benjamin's writings. Oh, that's another connection. As Masumi proposes in Semblance and Event, quote, "To speculate is to turn in on yourself." So this is what I'm doing. You turn in order to connect immanently with that, with what is absolutely outside, both in the sense of belonging to other formations, monadically separated from your present world, and in the sense of what may come but is unforeseeable. So I see, like, you know, this motion towards the rock as a kind of speculative pragmatic movement. So in the sense of what may come, but is unforeseeable, end of quote. The unforeseeable is that which must remain in the background of visibility, a modesty of presence, a self-presentation, like a pebble. But also, I think we need to attend to the unforeseeable, that pebble's sonic life, its music, not as a metaphor, but as a matter of fact, as the mattering of its facticity as mineral life. So fact number one, at the moment of the formation of the planet, about 4.5 billion years ago, Earth was composed of about 250 different kinds of minerals. Fact number two, at the moment of the formation of this speculation, Earth is composed of about 5,000 different kinds of minerals. What accounts for the astounding difference in numbers? According to geologists, the primary cause of the extraordinary multiplication of different kinds of minerals on the planet is a direct, literal, and somewhat surprising consequence of the advent of life. Indeed, early unicellular biotic life, traces of which have been found last year in Australia, dating as far back as 4.1 billion years, can be described as nothing more than little alchemical machines fabricated by certain minerals in order to create other new minerals. It's as if life is just a means for the mineral environment to produce and deposit all sorts of new minerals onto the planet. In a fantastic folding of mineral over mineral, in an unprecedented metabolic process where minerals assemble with heat and motion to precipitate the event of life, and where life reassembles and processes minerals to birth new elements on Earth, the link between life and mineral, flesh and stone, the links are so intimate so as to lead Robert Haysent, which is a chief geologist at the Carnegie Institute for Science, to recently state, and I quote, "Life itself began to make rocks for its own advantages. Trilobites invented shells, which are calcium carbonates, which is basically limestone," end of quote. This is limestone. So every single limestone formation on Earth is the outcome of maritime life. Limestone is the literal expression of flesh excreting onto the planet, a metamorphosed Earth, an expression of, quote, "the fact that the Earth is anyway already expressive in an ontological sense." And this is, again, Parikka in that same book. So this is more limestone, more life. The Earth as a metabolic organism expressing and expelling and excreting always more life out of Earth and more Earth out of life. It is this perfect symbiotic intermingling that leads Haysen, the geologist, to state, matter-of-factly, non-speculatively, as a kind of scientific certitude, that what had been until recently classified as and divided into animal kingdom and mineral kingdom can, and I quote, "no longer be separated. They are intertwined. Minerals make life, and life makes minerals." So this is the end of the preface, which is like for further, you know, speculation. These are the factoids. You know. In 1970, Roger Caillois, which is another connection to Nicole, publishes L'Écriture des Pierres, The Writing of Stones, a beautiful book where his passion for the mineral world rises to highly affective speculative reflections on what would be a stone's writing. Looking primarily into the entrails of the stones, he treated these as ancient diviners would treat the bowels of sacrificed animals, as a kind of cryptic writing. An effort for the planet to chronicle itself that is waiting to be deciphered and read, right? So it's a kind of cryptic modality of the planet writing its own chronicle. As Caillois writes, and I quote, "these are impossible scribblings in nature, written neither by men nor by devils, already present in the archives of geology, available for operations then inconceivable, the model of what would later be an alphabet. And Marguerite Yourcenar, in her preface to the book, she comments, and I quote, "This unconscious alphabet is immeasurably far away from the lines of letters we produce by a turn of the wrist, itself the slave of muscles, tendons, and neurons. Yet these authorless inscriptions may be regarded as a first draft of a chronicle of stones." So, first speculation. What if we depart from the fact of mineral and flesh entwinements that have produced these rocks and see in these stones grooves, lines, fractures, colors, the turns of other formations of muscles and memory, not as imprints of past impersonal writings, but as the current expression of mineral enfleshment? And, second speculation, what if we see these traces not as graphemes to be read, as Kaiwa would wish, not as lost drafts of a chronicle, but as the present compositions of sounds waiting to be heard, as long as we find the correct organ for accessing such subsonic composition? So these are the two speculations. So if we take these two speculations into a pragmatic experimentation, then the problem becomes one of inventing or creating a device that would be able to metabolize and express those sounds, which I don't really like to think that they are trapped in stone, but rather they are sounds constitutive of the stone itself as stone. Does that make sense? Okay, good. I have no idea. So one answer to this problem, like to how to build this machine, has been given by the Italian sculptor Pinuccio Sciolla. I don't know, do you know this name? Okay, you'll meet him in a moment. Who has made his artistic career creating what he calls pietre sonore, sound stones. And what is amazing about Sciolla's sound stones is that the mechanism or the machine that he found to access this sound is both as simple as a profound one, and I think it relates to the previous panel as well. He calls that machine caressing, which is great. The careful touch of flesh over mineral and of mineral over flesh. Now let's see if the technology works. I should have this. Yeah. No, wait. Oh, it's here. I'll translate the Italian.
Pietra ha un'anima, ha memoria ed elasticità, è senza tempo. È questa una delle prime cose che abbiamo imparato durante la nostra mattinata trascorsa in compagnia di Pinuccio Sciola. L'artista di Sansperate, in splendida forma, ci ha accolto nella sua abitazione museo, dove la sensazione è da subito stata quella di entrare in un luogo speciale, quasi di culto.
Tutti i suoni nascono da una vibrazione. Allora, carezzando la pietra.
So every sound comes from vibration, so you have to caress the stone. Tutto
queste lame che io sono riuscito a creare, si creano delle vibrazioni, e soltanto accarezzandole riesci ad ottenere, le vibrazioni che ti fanno salire, fanno venire fuori dall'interno della materia i suoi suoni. Io non faccio che sottolineare sempre che questi non sono i miei suoni, ma sono i suoni della materia che sono insiti dentro da quando la pietra si è formata. Quando la pietra si è formata, allora devi necessariamente tornare indietro nel tempo.
Questa che pietra è, per esempio?
Questo è un
I wanted to translate what he was saying. Did you kind of, no, it's better to translate, huh? So he's talking about like how the rock contains within itself the sound of the moment when it was formed, and that particular, and what you need to do is to find ways to access that sound, right, which has been contained in the rock forever. And the way he found was actually caressing the stone, and in this case it is limestone. Okay, so let me just go back to it and see if we find them. Yeah, there you go.
Si creano delle vibrazioni che soltanto accarezzandole riesci ad ottenere. Le vibrazioni che ti fanno salire, fanno venire fuori dall'interno della materia i suoi suoni. Io non faccio che sottolineare sempre che questi non sono i miei suoni, ma sono i suoni della materia che sono insiti dentro da quando la pietra si è formata. Quando la pietra si è formata, allora devi necessariamente tornare indietro nel tempo.
Questa che pietra è, per esempio?
Questo è un calcare e, come stavamo ascoltando da prima, questo è un suono liquido. Sono liquido perché la pietra è un calcare e il calcare da...
It's a liquid sound because the rock is a limestone, and limestone for him is what he calls fossilized water, right? Which goes back to this notion that it's basically limestone is corpses of animals, probiota. So here we are back. So we're back to the beginning, which is to the beginning of life's entanglement with minerals. As Sciola explains, the limestone is, quote, fossilized water. And moreover, most limestone is not only composed of skeletal fragments of marine animals, but in its formation requires, text on geology, the strong motions of waves. So it's not only about like the sedimentation, but you have to have like this kind of agitation so that the skeleton gets to be fragmented. So it's like wave motion plus bones that is produced actually through organic metabolism that produces the sound that then becomes the stone that then becomes expressed through caress. So limestone is non-metaphorically and exactly a mix of skeleton, microbacterial dejecta, and oceanic movement. All we need to do in order to hear these many waves, vibrations, flashes, bones, is to caress the rock so that music may come out. As Sciola says, music comes out. So here we are very far from the famous or infamous Professor Challenger, Arthur Conan Doyle's character in the short story When the World Screamed. So do you know this story? So it's like basically there's a short story by Arthur Conan Doyle in which this mad scientist postulates that between the core of the Earth and the surface of the Earth, there's a layer of life kind of plasma, something like this, like a gelatinous being. And in that story, he basically perforates the earth so to prove that this entity, this between mineral and life, actually existed. And the proof was actually to penetrate the earth in order to, quote, make the earth scream. And there's a moment in which, like, you know, to talk about psychoanalysis, there's a moment in which actually the device penetrates the crust of the earth, gets into this layer of this strange beast or monstrous beast, and the earth screams, right? And this is proof that Professor Challenger was correct. So here, we are very far away from that because it's a different kind of affect, of course. But at the same time, I want to consider how in this kind of resonant correspondence between flesh and stone that Sciola revealed through caressing, sometimes it is actually the earth that makes us scream. And in doing so, it fuses flesh and mineral into one same formation. So, and then now we enter into part three of the speculation. So, which has to do with rock climbing and, you know, and maybe, yeah, you know, the sonic aspects of rock climbing. And really, I want to, like, rock climbing as a non-heroic activity, but actually an activity of absolute failure and a kind of daily exercise in extreme modesty, because you're always losing somehow. So I'm speculating that rock climbing, rather than a matter of hand reading the secret graphemes of the rock, because there's a lot of talk about, you know, I have to read the route, right, first. So it's not about, so I'm proposing it's not about reading the route. So reading the secret graphemes of the rock, as in Kaiwa's project, is in fact a vibrational activity. Rock climbing is a sound event between two kinds of deeply intertwined, historically co-formative modes of enfleshing, the human flesh and mineral flesh, or human mineral and mineral humanity, if you want. And I want to speculate further that those two fleshes, which geologists now tell us cannot be separated, since they are vastly co-formative of one another, only correspond in a felicitous collaboration, only result in a successful climbing once they resonate. So I'm going to bring you two cases. Case number one I call the obscene granite, and it starts here. And actually, I will quote, just not to be completely self-referential, I'm quoting for a book by a dance scholar, Sally Ann Ness, that just came out, it's just been published. It's a fantastic delirium on Yosemite, and it's called Choreographies of Landscape, Signs of Performance in Yosemite National Park. And she's basically picking up Pierce's semiotics and trying to read the rock as a kind of message to us as a rock. But anyway, I want to quote from her because it's an experience that perhaps many rock climbers have gone through. So she's, this is just pedagogical. She's going up a granite wall and she's going through a crevice. It's not this one, but this one shows the crevice better. So what you need to do when you climb through a crevice is, like, you need to insert your wrist or, you know, a body part and twist it so that you hold it there and you keep, like, so you become like one with this, you have to become one with the stone somehow. So I'm just going, this is her climbing. This is, she's a proper anthropologist, so she decided to rock climb at a very early, late age, so, and she's doing great. So this is some kind of unnamed crevice that she's going up. And now I'm just going to read, it's a long quote, but I think it's beautiful. So she's going up this crevice, and then all of a sudden, what happens is that the crevice starts to go wider and wider, so the fist technique is not working. So she puts her leg inside the crevice to see if she can get some support, and at that moment, her hip gets completely caught, and she can't get out. And she starts crying for help after a while, and the people up cannot hear her, and the belayer cannot hear her, and she's basically stuck, and she's trying to figure out, what am I going to do to get out of here, because the rock and her body became one. So, quote, "I carefully wriggled, pushed, and pulled to try to budge the tie into moving, but to no avail. I wondered how anyone might be brought up to this place to assist me if I could not find a way to release myself from this jam on my own, or if I were to break the femur bone. After I had repeatedly failed to dislodge the thigh, I finally said something like, 'My leg is stuck,' out loud. Only two of my companions could hear me at this point, my belayer and our lead climber, who was perched on a ledge taking pictures. I did not say the words very loudly. The announcement and the appeal for assistance it contained was half-hearted. I was loath to have either of these two know that I was having trouble, especially this kind of trouble. However, there seemed nothing else to do at this point other than to ask them for advice. Neither climber, however, seemed to grasp what my situation was. Neither offered advice of any note. Feeling left entirely to my own devices, I continued to try to loosen the thigh, but with no success. It was no long after this that I lost control of my language. In a vehement exhalation, tears welling up, I burst out, fuck! As far as I can remember, this was the first time I had ever shouted this word. It was definitely the first time I had ever uttered it while climbing. In my experience, it came out involuntarily, exploding. Its expression dismayed me. In that same moment, however, my jammed leg also came loose from the crack. I had no awareness of how this happened. My sense of the action was focused entirely on the utterance I had made. I had said a word that people in my family simply never said. That was all. That my leg was suddenly moving freely once again was something like a miracle. It was not something I had done. So I'm thinking about, you know, this kind of the not I and the expression of the sound that all of a sudden makes the, literally the rock respond and set her free. So I agree with Mass that what had been done was not through the agency of an I, but through the vibrational element produced by that always climber-friendly word, fuck. When I first read this passage, I could not help but to laugh, since I remembered the many, many times when I find myself negotiating a difficult crux on the rock, and nothing will make me move until the word comes out in English, fuck. So therefore, like, it means that it's not about the signification. This, what I'm trying to say is, like, there's something about this F-U-C-K, like, there's something, like, about the fricative and the that responds to granite. And I tell you, and I'm going to say why, you know, there's a reason. There's a reason why granite responds to this. So, you know, and in shame, like, you know, but since Barbara showed her naked, I can show, you know, there's always a kind of modesty, but, you know, since I'm coming out, it's like, this is me climbing, like, granite in Rio. And I'm in Rio, I speak, of course, I'm Brazilian, I speak Portuguese, but it comes in English. So there's something... This is a route that I always have trouble when I get to the crux up there. So I remember being on the 5.10B crux on route Louise Arnaud, which is this one, in the Babilonia Granite Hill in Rio de Janeiro, and going through all the moves, only moved by the power of that sound. Fuck. As I yelled, the rock would reveal its many holds, otherwise totally invisible without the screams. It's like this is the like you don't know where you're going, and you scream and it appears. So it's produced, like the rock produces. And that's something like that rock climbers constantly say, like today the rock has changed. I don't know. It's the same route, but it changed today. So there was no caress, but there was a kind of hard resonance. No wonder, despite the fact that granite in Rio is next to the ocean, it so happens that granite is also one of the kinds of what geologists call igneous rock, which is different than limestone. In other words, it is formed directly from magma or lava activity. And therefore, granite is infernal. It spurts out from the depths of the earth. It is truly alien to life. It precedes all this metabolic transformation of this 250 minerals into the 5,000. It is essential anti-life. It is a rock that is not enfleshed. A solid flame that it is, granite responds only to harsh, inflamed sounds. This is my speculation. Obscene, short, curt, and cutting. Fuck. And here I end with the final speculation that is a reality proof. Do you have time? It's just going to be like 3 minutes. It's the 2013 ascent of the so-called hardest rock climb in the world, so far only completed by two humans, Chris Sharma, the American rock climber, and Adam Ondra from the Czech Republic. And this is the infamous 5.15C La Dura in Oliana, Catalonia, Spain. And it's important to note that La Dura is limestone cliff. And I wanted to show you something. And I'm just, because there's always like this epic thing about rock climbing that I really want to get rid of, I'll show just a little bit of Adam Ondra talking. And then, well, even he's going to do it. So they set up the hardest rock climb. 515C is like impossible. No one can do it. So they set this up, this impossibility for failure. But eventually, unfortunately, they succeed. So, and Adam Ondra is the first one that succeeds. You'll see him doing this. And they both Adam and Chris Sharma, like the really top rock climbers at the moment, they spend a month like trying and trying and trying and trying. They can't do it. They can't do it, okay? So what I'm going to show you is like a little bit of Adam Ondra still like within the anatomical correctness, trying to figure out how is he going to do it. And then a little bit of the beginning through image, and then I'm just going to take the image out and we're just going to listen, and you'll get it to the end, okay? So, and this is the singularity, I guess, like, okay? So let's see if it's in the right. I need to find the spot, hold on. It's here.
In the same way that
this
I had
is Sharma. Okay, this is...
The more I tried it, I have the roots so wired that it doesn't feel any easier. There is no margin to make anything more efficient. My muscles just memorize the move so perfectly that I either have to be a little bit stronger or just have a little bit more luck.
So this is the beginning. You can see like the oceanic in this, right? So there he goes. Oh, can I hear? Can we hear him? Does he have to be plugged to hear him? I thought that.
No, you should be able to hear it still.
You should be here. Should be able to hear. Shit. Because I wanted you to. Maybe you can close your eyes.
HDMI?
What's that?
Is it HDMI?
You can turn on, just hide.
Okay, right. Hold on. Sorry.
Or just have a little bit more.
Okay,
luck.
You can hear me. Right? Listen, listen. The first time that he starts doing it from the start. That's how you climb. Okay, thanks, that's all. It's like...